Pete, or Dr. Rollins, is from Belfast, Northern Ireland. He is a prolific thinker, philosopher, and he has written two books so far, How Not to Speak to God, not is in parentheses, which makes it a very interesting title, and The Fidelity of Betrayal. February, Orthodox Heretic comes out.
And in March, February.
Yeah, March, February. And that's a collection of parables and stories. If you go on to peterrollins.net, there's a couple parables up there. They're very interesting, thought-provoking. Even my very evangelically conservative mother really liked Pete's parable when I sent it to her. So they're very open and very thought-provoking, and we're happy for him to be here. So Peter Rollins.
Thanks very much. Stop it. You just encourage me. I'll never stop. So has anybody not written a book? Yes, they seem like, you know, there's a few hands, yeah. Anybody not got a blog? Everyone, no, there's one no blog, yeah. Anyone not got a Mac? No, yeah. Oh, there's a few, yeah, okay. You have to leave now, I think. That's the, anybody not use stones in their worship service? That's usually when stones and tea candles seems to be what we all have to use. Yeah, I'm very excited about The Orthodox Heretic. It's my attempt to kind of make what I'm doing a bit more accessible and get it out there. So I'm kind of excited about that. I'll maybe talk about it later, but probably will forget. you know, it's great to be here. I'm kind of on a six-week tour, and I'm kind of weekend, so I'm a bit frazzled. And so I'm drinking coffee, and I'm going to be all over the place. So don't worry, just ignore me. I kind of rewrote some of my talks when I was jet-lagged and lost in translation wakefulness. So that's never a good thing to do. When I was also on painkillers because I had a cold. So some of this was written at 5 in the morning with painkillers after 48 hours of no sleep. So let's hope it makes some sort of sense. What else should I say? Oh, yeah, and it's great to be here. I love being in America because you guys, it's, unlike the Irish, Americans, even if they don't like you, they say that they do. Whereas, yeah, in Ireland, even if we do like you, we say that we don't, because we kind of like to dig at you and take you down a few pegs. So it's really nice to be somewhere where people are nice, even if they don't really think what you're saying, if they think you're a heretic and dodgy, which I am. And, you know, and I also kind of like the get up and go that I find in America. There's a lot of get up and go. I was, last time I was here in New York, there was a pizza thing. It was just like a little place, guy selling pizzas, and it had, you know, best pizzas in the world. I was like, wow, that's dedication. I mean, imagine the amount of traveling and the amount of money that guy had to spend to find out that his pizzas were the best in the world. I mean, that's incredible. It's mind-blowing. You could probably fund, I don't know, the IMF or something. That's incredible. It's like, if it was back home, it would be, you know, our pizzas are pretty rubbish. But sure, you're standing outside anyway, and it's probably raining. So why don't you just come in? You know, so I it's nice to be somewhere where there's energy. So I suppose what I want to do, I've got three sessions, and I think I'll start with the first session. I want to explore a problem with how we often conceive and conceptualize God in the contemporary church. Then in the second session, I want to maybe look at how we can overcome that problem. And in the third, I want to kind of maybe get to some sort of kind of practical stuff if we get a chance. So what's the problem? Well, there's an old anecdote from we told back home during the Troubles. There was this thing called the Troubles. We had a little bit of a problem. And the police force at the time was called the RUC. By the way, what time have I got to? Got 40. Yeah, okay. Just tell me to stop or something. So the RUC, they were the police force at the time. And the story goes that they got some money to come over to America and train with the FBI and the CIA. One of these kind of, you know, team-building things, all go out to forests and all hug each other and stuff, you know. So they get like 12 of their best guys, and they fly over on this jolly, and they get there. And of course, yeah, the team builder brings them out to this big forest. And he says to the three teams, he says, you've got to go into the forest and retrieve a rabbit. So fair enough. So the FBI go first. They're in there for about 10 minutes, and then you hear a single shot ring through the air. And one of them comes back with a rabbit, bullet through the center of the head, you know, perfect shot. It's well done. So then it's the CIA's turn. And the CIA go in, absolutely silent, not a sound. And then about 15 minutes later, there's a slight snap of a twig, and they come out, and there's a dead rabbit. No, not a mark on its body. You know, they just find it that way, right? So, and so it's the RUC's turn. So they get their flat jackets on, they get their plastic bullet rounds, they get their batons, and they fire in there. And they're in there for ages. And eventually, they come out, and the biggest RUC man's got a big smile on his face, and he's dragging a bear behind him, right? And the guy goes, he says, first of all, he says, you're in there for 3 weeks. And he says, and secondly, that's not a rabbit, that's a bear. And the RUC man just winks, looks the bear deep into the eyes, and the bear starts to shake and goes, I'm a rabbit, I'm a rabbit. Right, okay. Now, that tells you something about the RUC at the time and their less than good practices. But it also makes me think of how so much Christianity is, or my Christianity anyway, that it felt like I was trying to, people go, I'm a Christian, because they want something. They're either afraid to go to some horrible place after death, or they want meaning in their life, or they want to get out with the girl in the youth group, or whatever it is. It's an external thing, but it's not internal. It's not radically subjective in the Kierkegaardian sense. It's something that's imposed from without. I'm a Christian. Hence, Kierkegaard, of course, says, you know, a nut lover would prefer one nut with a kernel than a thousand nuts with no kernel. You know, give me one person with a heart, you know, rather than 10,000 people with no heart. Kind of see a lot of kind of mission work in this way, right? I don't want to spill this. So I'll put it here. just freaking you out, sorry. So a lot of evangelism, I see, kind of works in this way, that what you're doing is you're trying to get people to make a commitment, either through fear or through a desire for something else. So, for example, a desire for meaning. People kind of look for God because they desire meaning. But then you don't desire God, you desire meaning. You know, you want to go to heaven or something like that. Well, then you don't desire God, you desire heaven. You know, don't want to go to hell. Well, then you don't desire God, you desire not going to hell, right? It's like, you know the old story about the church that they were trying to get converts up? So they put a sign outside saying $100 if you convert to Christianity. And the two guys are walking to the pub and they're broke. And one of them goes, look at that. You go in, make the whole conversion thing. We'll get the $100, we'll go down to the pub, have a laugh, right? So guy says, this is a brilliant idea. He goes in, and he's in there for about half an hour. And eventually he comes out and his mate goes, so did you get the money for the pub? And his friend just nods his head in disapproval and said, is money all you non-Christians think about? Right? Now, and of course, Dick is the idea that somehow through wanting $100, you could have some sort of genuinely transformative reconfiguring of one's existence. The matrix of your life changed into the imitation of Christ. It's ridiculous. And yet there's something about that style of mission that seems almost ubiquitous today. This is why I think I want to try and rediscover that beautiful tradition of anti-evangelism. And anti-evangelism kind of looks like this. When someone comes to you and says, I really want God, you refuse to give God. You refuse it. Basically, for example, if someone dies or someone's just come out of a relationship and they come to you and go, I really want to find God. But they don't. They don't. They want to, you know, to relieve their suffering. And imagine, you know, when someone comes out of a relationship, a divorce or a long-term relationship, you know, the last thing they need sometimes is to rebound straight into another relationship. But you're looking for anybody to fulfill your needs. And actually, as a friend, sometimes the best thing to do is say, you know what? You need to calm down. You need to get a sense of yourself. Let's hang out. Let's, you know, go back. You used to like art. Go back and do art. Go back and get yourself sorted. And you know what? When you feel comfortable with yourself, and when you kind of feel that you've come to terms with this break, well, then that's a good time to start looking for a new relationship. But not now. So it's like you're trying to be the anti-matchmaker. Because everyone knows, as soon as you're going, I need someone, you're sending out these signals of keep away from me. You know, that's the worst time to ever meet anybody. And then, as we all know, that logic where whenever you suddenly let go of that and you're simply happy to be who you are and you don't feel the need to have somebody, then that's the time, isn't it, where you kind of meet somebody? The time whenever you're not looking for it. When you're looking for it frantically, it's always elusive, always a void. And then when you're not looking for it, it comes. Now, this also, I think, helps us understand how need works with God. I mean, if you think about, again, a relationship, and you're alone, You've just split up with someone. You're wanting to find someone who'll kind of make you feel less lonely and someone that you're attracted to. Now, do you desire a person? Well, you desire an abstract person. You don't desire anybody in particular. You can't desire somebody until you meet them. How can you desire someone you don't know, right? You can't desire a person until you actually encounter them. All you can do is desire a person with certain qualities, you know, certain things that you're looking for. And it's only whenever you encounter someone that you start to need them. Now, generally, whenever in the regular world, you desire something you don't have. So I desire a computer because I don't have it. And then when I have the computer, I can enjoy it. But I don't desire it anymore because I have it. But in the world of human relationships, desire is not sated. It's not stopped when you meet someone, when you meet your beloved. It started there. Hence, you know, do you get Doctor Who here? Doctor Who travels in the TARDIS, which is this machine that travels through time and space. And if you've seen it, on the outside, it's this small frame. It's like a telephone box. But inside, it opens up to this expanse of infinite proportions. Now, this is a beautiful analogy, I think, of human subjectivity. This fragile frame that we are, this fragile fleshly frame, opens up to an interior world of vast proportions. So there is a sense in which, and this is how you understand eschatology for me in Christianity, there's a sense in which when the person is there in front of you, your beloved, they are still to come. They're experienced as a universe that is present and yet not there. A rupture in your world. So for me, eschatology is misunderstood when it's about the future event. It's about the now of the not yet, which is what human beings are. Hence, the Jewish parable. I should start to breathe. Okay. I do this. I'll go blue. You'll watch me going gradually bluer and bluer, and then I'll pass out. I've got so much to say. And it's only one day to say it all. I get exhausted. Right. What was I saying there? Anything? Was it? Jewish parable, yeah. Blanchard says, the Messiah returns one day, and this guy recognizes the Messiah. He's like 60 years old, not the Messiah, this guy. He says, wow, it's the Messiah. Runs up, falls at his feet, says, I have waited all my life for you to come. I have waited and prayed and wept for your arrival. And then he says, I have one question for you, my Messiah. The Messiah says, what is it? And he says, tell me, when will you arrive? When will you arrive? Okay. Now, that, of course, we're between two incomings. That's a sense in which the presence of God is never, in postmodern philosophy, reduced to the metaphysics of presence. In other words, God's reception is never conception. In other words, when God comes near, the mystery is not dissipated. The mystery is deepened and brought closer. Hence, Barth says, God is not made known in Christ. Neither does God remain unknown. God is made known as unknown. In other words, the mystery is brought near to us, not dissipated. God remains a secret in the sharing. If I share a secret, it's no longer a secret. But God is the secret who remains secret in the sharing. Why am I saying? Oh, yeah, need. Yeah. So whenever somebody you love, your beloved, arrives, they're to come. They're experienced as that which is yet to arrive in their very presence. And so you begin to desire. And it's only then that you discover your need for your beloved. So take the example of a child. When a child's born, parents are so annoying, They say, oh, you have kids and, you're never complete without them. And, your life is so, this child's so important, it's vital, most important thing ever. That's of course true. But it's retroactively true. Right? What happens is the birth of the child retroactively creates the need. Retroactively creates the desire to have the child eternally. In other words, the truth of the parent is, I never needed you until you showed up, and now I realize that I've always needed you. So retroactively, you look back and go, I've always needed you, but I only needed you in the year 2005 when you were born, and then retroactively realize that all my life I was waiting for you. So same with relationships and all that. I didn't need you until I met you, and now I realize that I've always needed you. So in a sense, do we need God before God shows up? Or do we only start to need God when God arrives? Instead of thinking that people who don't know God need God and people who have God don't, perhaps the people who don't have God don't need God, and only people who need God are those who have God. You think about it like a coffee shop waiting for someone who you love and they're not there. The person's not there for everybody in the coffee shop, but you're the only one who experiences it. You're the only one who feels it. Their absence is present to you. So there's a sense in which, oh yeah, that you experience their non-presence. It's present to you. The phone not ringing is louder than if the phone was ringing. There's a, again, so I was, you know, have to play in postmodern thought, but go like, so it's not that people who don't know God have not experienced God and those who know God do. It's those who don't know God, those who do know God have not experienced God, the non-experience of God, the experience of God's absence, even of God's presence. Blah, 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 blah. It's all really interesting stuff, you know. But it's not really what I want to talk about. I just kind of go off on tangents. It is important enough, mind you. Let's see. So anti-evangelism, I kind of covered that a bit. Oh yeah, right. So, we need to move forward. The problem is, and Bonhoeffer brings this out, he says, as soon as God becomes something that we need in order to, because we don't have meaning or because we're afraid or we're whatever, he says, God enters the world from outside, as he calls it the Deus Ex Machina. And he says, the Deus Ex Machina is a device in a play or in a book which basically solves a problem that can't be solved in the narrative itself. So the perfect example is Dallas. In Dallas, in season 7, Patrick Duffy, who was, was playing Bobby Ewing, right, you know, Bobby Ewing, they killed him off. His sister-in-law was killed him off, you know. And then they realized, actually, people watched Dallas because of Bobby Ewing, you know. He was a really popular character, and their figures dipped. So what did they do? Some of you will know. They had to figure out a way of bringing him back. So at the end of the season, what they did is, I think his wife opened up the bathroom door in the morning. She woke up and she walks in, and there he is having a shower. And what they say is, yeah, the whole of season 7, dream sequence. Dream sequence. Yeah. Didn't I? So we'll just start from season 6. And that was their way. That was their Deus Ex Machina. They found an irreconcilable problem in the script, and the only way to kind of get out of the problem was to wheel in this implausible solution. And so Bonhoeffer says, yes, well, if God is there to give you, provide a reason for why things happen, then he says, well, you're just bringing in God to explain our ignorance. And the problem with that, there's loads of problems with it. One of the problems, however, is as our ignorance recedes, and as we can explain more and more things, we need God less and less. So in the old days, we may have needed God to explain tidal waves, plagues, why crops failed. But then as science progresses, we don't need God to explain those things. And eventually God gets to the point where we just need God to come in and give us an explanation for why there's something rather than nothing. You know, give us a justification for something very basic. Now this is where you get to modern philosophy. I won't go into it in any depth, but with people like Descartes and Kant, God suddenly becomes this what's called a guarantor of meaning. It means that life's okay. You know, I'll go to sleep and I'll wake up the next day and I'm all right, and everything's fine in the world. So God becomes this guarantee that your life is meaningful. Basically, because if we're not able to face up to life without it. So God becomes this third. A great example of this is in the old anecdote about a guy who's washed up on this desert island. He's a student, scummy old student, you know, he's doing anthropology or something, and he's got 3 hours a week, and he's on his voyage, and a ship sinks, he washes up on the desert island, to his amazement, he's been washed up on shore with this beautiful actress, anybody famous actress? I don't know actresses' names. Anybody? Catherine Zeta-Jones, I always use her. I don't know why, because, you know, that Welsh accent isn't great. So she doesn't, you know, but she's very beautiful. So he washes up and he goes, wow, look, Catherine Zeta-Jones, this is brilliant. We're the only two people who survived. And of course, she's no interest at all in him. But like, they're the only two people on the whole island. So after about a month of her continually pushing him back and saying, I'm not interested, one thing leads to another and they have this night together. So the next morning, wake up, and the guy goes, oh, it's brilliant. I'm so glad after months and months this finally happened. And he said, but I'd like you to do one more thing for me. And she's like, what? And she's like, well, I'd like you to draw a moustache on your face, right, and wear this cap and wear these clothes of mine. And she's going like, well, is this some kind of crazy thing, weird thing? I don't know if I want to do it. He said, no, you'll understand. I just want you to look like one of my friends from back home. And then once you've dressed, I want you to come down to the beach and meet me. So sure enough, she does, and then she goes down to the beach, and the guy sees her and goes, oh, how's it going, mate? How's it going? I'm so glad to see you. He says, you'll never guess who I just slept with. Right. Now, the idea being that he couldn't simply enjoy being with Catherine Zeta-Jones. He had to tell somebody. You know, there had to be a third, someone who kind of gave the thing meaning and significance. Now, this is a role that God starts to play in religion. God is this third that helps us to enjoy or cope with life. We can't look at it directly. We need a third. Now, this is a very human natural reaction. When you're an infant and you're pushing, like, I don't know, a pram or a plastic pram around the room, there's no implicit enjoyment to that. You only enjoy it because you see the enjoyment of your parents. And so they love you. Oh, you're pushing a wee pram around. That's lovely. And then they go, oh, this is the you know, it's the desire of the other that teaches you what to desire. And raise your arms like that. So you learn your desire through a third, through somebody in. Because obviously pushing plastic around is not a pleasurable thing, you know, it's just not. But it becomes because you see it gives pleasure to those who are around you. So it's a natural response. And part of growing up is taking that pleasure on yourself rather than always having a third, a father figure, whatever, telling you what you're doing wrong or something, you know. So God becomes this third. And that helps us, because life seems like a horrible place sometimes. Not only in suffering, not only when we look at the Holocaust, not only when we look at death and destruction, where we want a third who say, oh, it's okay, you know, there's a meaning for that. Oh, that's a test. That's because there's free will or whatever it is. Something to give it meaning, because we're terrified that it's meaningless. We're terrified that actually that horror is just the way life is. But even joy is terrible, because every time you have a beautiful experience, going, this is just maybe fleeting. This relationship might not last. And you want to give everything eternal meaning. You want that walk in the park with that person to have eternal significance. We want it to. And so we've got this tendency to push out, to want to. And so as Voltaire says, if God did not exist, we would invent God. God becomes this thing which helps us not really face up to the possibility that life is comic. Not even tragic, but comic. Schopenhauer says, you know, life isn't even worthy of being called a tragedy. Because tragedy means that, you know, there's some sort of, dignity to it. Even a tragedy, there's, you know, the tragic figures are the figures who stand up defiant against the absurdity of the universe. He says, no, it's not even, life is not even tragic, it's just comic. It signifies nothing, it's ridiculous, it's pointless, and it ends. Now, I think that we should be able to face up to that possibility. Because the worst thing is, I think, whenever God becomes the crutch that we need in order to avoid confrontation with the abyss, you know, where you look into the abyss, and the abyss looks back at you. I'd love to get a t-shirt, you know, I looked into the abyss, and all I got was this lousy t-shirt. I think that would be good. Yeah, that would be good. I just thought of that there now. But I'll have to remember that idea. Yeah. Or my friend looked into the abyss, and all I got was this lousy t-shirt. So I want to come back to these kind of notions, because this is all maybe sounds a bit crazy, but ultimately, yeah, so God becomes this thing which justifies our fears and our ignorance and all that. God becomes the deus ex machina. Now, the problem here, again, is that when God fulfills this rule, right, God then is an idea, a thought. And so whenever Nietzsche said God is dead, this is what he was attacking. Nietzsche has famously said, you know, a crazy guy walks into the middle of the marketplace one day, crying out, I seek God. I seek God. And as there were many people in the marketplace who didn't believe in God, they laughed and they ridiculed. Some said, where is your God? Have you lost him? Has he gone on a sea voyage? Is he afraid of us? And the madman transfixes everyone with his glances. He says, where is God? I'll tell you where God is. God is dead and you have murdered him. His blood stains your hands. Now, there's a number of ways to approach this parable. But one way of saying it is that Nietzsche is drawing out the idea that God is dead in the sense of God no longer has any transformative power. God has simply become an idea. So we're basically practical atheists. We're theoretical theists. So we believe in God in our minds, and we're practically atheists. We live as though God does not exist. So we rely on our jobs for money, and we rely on our friendships for meaning and all that. So God simply is reduced to a private sphere and doesn't really have any public significance anymore. Now, the other interesting thing, by the way, is Nietzsche was not actually talking to religious people. He was talking to those who didn't believe in God. The great thing about Nietzsche is you can't really be offended by him because he hates everybody. So you kind of go like, oh, thank you. Oh, there you go. You can't, you know, he hates Christians and atheists and the whole everything. So his problem with Here's, people who didn't believe in God says, well, you really do. He says, okay, oh, you don't have a holy people anymore. Oh, right. Oh, well, you've got the Europeans now. You don't maybe have the Jewish kind of people, but the Europeans. Oh, you don't have a holy mission anymore to convert people. Oh, no, you do. Bring in European culture to the rest of civilization, you know. You think you don't have a new Jerusalem. You do. You have this utopian vision of a future world. Says, you guys have this kind of, because religion, it could be defined, Bonhoeffer defines it as anything, God or whatever word you want to use, historical necessity, Stalin talked about, destiny, Hitler talked about, whatever it is, that grounds everything, that makes you feel good and makes you feel fine. And he says, that God's dead. There's no power in that God anymore. You know, you are practical atheists. And just why don't you admit it? You don't understand the significance of the death of God. So what happens whenever God becomes this inner thing? Well, as we see, it means you can go to church on a Sunday and you don't really have to necessarily think about changing your job on a Monday. You can, that revelation and Christian truth is something that can be heard without being heeded. You know the old Italian story that supposedly the Italian soldiers during the Second World War, they loved their opera and they were quite cowardly. And it says that at one stage at the front line, the commander said, right, lads, over the top, and none of the soldiers moved. He says, right, lads, over the top. And nobody moved. And he said it a third time. And then one of the soldiers turns to the others and says, oh, what a wonderful voice he has. You know, what a wonderful voice he has. You know? And the idea being you can hear the message without heeding it. You can hear it without acting on it, without it actually doing something. So you create this ironic distance. Now, I will tell one more anecdote, can I? Because this is a good one. This is about this minister. And she's sitting on a Sunday afternoon reading a book, and there's a knock on the door. And she opens the door, and there's this parishioner, big guy, sweating. He's upset, really upset. He's holding back tears. He says, what's wrong? He says, oh, you won't believe it. Just down the road, there's a man and wife. And he says, the guy just lost his job. The woman's too sick to work. You know, she's looking after her sick mother who lives in the attic. And they've got three kids. If they don't pay the rent by tomorrow, 9 o'clock, landlord's going to kick them out in the street, even though it's the middle of winter. And so the minister goes, that's terrible. We're going to have to do something about that. I'll get some money. He says, how do you know them? Oh, he says, I'm the landlord. Right? Now, this is the ironic gesture par excellence. This is where one can, you know, intellectually in your inner world have all these concerns, and yet in your outer existence, they don't live out in terms of what you do, in terms of your social activity. So subjectively, you're concerned, and yet your objective engagement with the world doesn't reflect that. Now, if the landlord had a tension between those two things, that would be fine. You know, I'll have to make money and da-da-da. But the joke works because there's no tension. He doesn't experience this as a tension. And I think this is amazing because I think actually we don't experience this as a tension either. I wouldn't have a problem if people experienced this thing as a tension. But we don't. We can go on a protest against environmental issues and yet drive there in a big car. So the ironic gesture is where you go onto a 70s disco, dressed in the 70s clothes, dancing to the 70s music, while ridiculing the 70s clothes and ridiculing the music. In other words, you laugh at the very social activity you're engaged in as you're engaged in it. So that's the ironic gesture. So you can actually ridicule and attack the very thing that you're actually immersed in at the very moment of speaking. Now, how do we sustain this? There's a way of sustaining it. And the way we sustain it is through what kind of Marx or Zizek would call a fetish. And a fetish is an object that we know is not magical, but we treat it as if it is, and it has magical properties. Now, the idea being, we can all talk about how making lots of money, having a bigger car, having a nicer house won't make us any happier. We all agree on that. The problem is, as soon as we walk away from the conversation, we'll act as if money makes you happier. We'll act as if having a better car makes you better. We'll act as if having a better house will make you happier. The point is not to convince the head. The point is to convince your social activity. That's what a fetish is. Karl Marx, you know, the point is not to convince people about something like, you know, having a bigger house is not necessarily going to, you know, make you a better person. It's about trying to convince your social self. This is the kind of fetish object. In psychoanalysis, you could say, you know, there are clinical examples of someone whose beloved dies, and they cope with it really well. They know they've died, but they don't shed a tear. But they've got this dog that they both, you know, that lived with them both. But it's when the dog dies that the person breaks down. It's when the dog dies that suddenly all of the emotions are let loose. Why? Because the dog was acting as this fetish. It was the person could fully, in their head, understand the situation, and yet they didn't feel it. They weren't actually challenged to change it. And it was only when that got taken away that they had to face the reality of the situation, the full reality of their situation. Like a security blanket for a child. The child can run around as long as it's got the security blanket. But when the security blanket is taken away, the child has a bit of a crisis, a trauma. It has to face the reality. Now, the situation doesn't change, but the child no longer has this fetishistic object, which allows them to not feel their context, and they have to address and face it. Hence, Marx talked about religion as the imaginary flowers and the chains of our oppression. What he was saying was that, you know, religion can so often act as a way of not letting us see actually the horror of the situation we're in, whether it's jobs we don't like, whether it's global injustice, whether it's a relationship that is unhealthy and destructive for us. And as long as we've got this religious activity, we can somehow continue to face up to that. But then if you have a crisis of faith and suddenly you have to look at your situation, you see the chains of your oppression. Now, Marx says you could despair at that point, but you could also, it's the only time when you can really maybe make a difference. You have to see your oppression. So that's why Nietzsche said religion and alcohol are the same thing. He says he despised them both. He said they're both ways of getting drunk and escaping reality, you know. And he says, I want to fully engage with reality. Now, I think Christianity actually at its best is about that in a much more radical way than humanism and stuff. So we'll get onto that later. But I'm trying to get the problem first. I'm trying to kind of get to the heart of an issue. So what does fetishistic activity mean then? Well, it means this, and this is the really, this will really boil your heads, hopefully. I'm just going to keep an eye on the time. We're doing okay, are we? Yeah. I don't know if this works. This is brought home from Tajikistan by a friend of mine, and he brought home about four, and they all systematically have broken down, but this is still going. Good communist stuff. There you go. There's a train on the back of it, like. It's good. Oh, yep. 11:15, and it's 10:02 now. That's perfect. So this fetishistic object, this creates, right, so where we've got to now, in the long and the short, is if God suddenly becomes this deus ex machina, this crutch that we need because we don't want to face up to the possibility that life is meaningless, or we don't want to face up to the possibility that that everything we know and have will collapse into nothing, right? So we need God to kind of somehow make us feel better about life, or to avoid, just to avoid the concrete thing of maybe we have a job we hate. Maybe, you know, we're in a situation, in a family situation, which is horrible, and we don't want to face up to it or whatever, or we're living with somebody who we have an unhealthy relationship with, whatever it is, right? You know, if God becomes this thing which kind of helps us cope with it rather than change it, That's a problem. God becomes like this fetish, this object that prevents us from really engaging with our lives. Then, at an even deeper level, church activities can become a fetish. If you take the Matrix film, for example, in the Matrix, the first film, you've got Neo, who's like a messianic figure, and you have the city of Zion, which is like this group of rebels who are fighting against the machines. And so you've got the site of resistance, okay? Now, a lot of churches use this film to express, kind of as an analogy of how we should think about Christianity. This is the site of resistance against the world, against the machines. But then, of course, as the films progress, the irony is, it's the machines who allow Neo to exist. It's the machines who built the city of Zion. It's the machines who let the whole system run. So all of the first film, we're sitting there rooting for these freedom fighters. And then we realise, oh, actually, it's the machines themselves that are allowing the space for this to take place. And Neo is just the latest in a long line of messiahs who have come along because the machines just keep generating them, right? Why? Because the machines understand that in order to fully oppress, you need to create air vents. You know, if you're going to oppress a people, you've got to give them a place where they can transgress. You know, go 10 miles an hour above the speed limit. We all know it's not a problem. That's a transgression? Yeah, but it's a transgression that is allowed and instantiated by the authorities. So it's not a real transgression. And so we feel we're transgressing, but it's a transgression that's allowed. Protest movements, you know, they're all allowed, you know, because it's an air vent. Go out and protest against something and it kind of we feel better. And it's like almost a therapeutic thing. And so bizarrely, we're constantly changing things so that everything remains the same, so that nothing changes. So Batman is my perfect example of this. I like Batman. But look at Batman. Okay, by day he wears a suit. He goes to Wayne Industries. He makes billions of pounds, billions of dollars, billions. So much so that he can afford to fund a military campaign in his spare time with all this really high-tech equipment. And they don't even notice Wayne Industries. Don't even notice the money going because they've got so much money, right? So by day he does that, and then by night he uses this stuff to go out and beat up on criminals, right? Now then. What he's obsessed with is subjective violence. So at night he gets his Batman suit on and he puts his mask on and he goes out and beats up on criminals. He's trying to help the city of Gotham. He's obsessed with subjective violence. But he hasn't understand that is it not the objective violence of industries like Wayne Industries who can make such vast sums of money that actually generates the subjective violence he's fighting on the streets. So by night he's beaten up on criminals who are the direct result of poverty and economic problems. And is the issue not impotent? One Batman for the whole city. So he's going out and beating up. He's not going to do anything. So the next film, supposedly the next film is where he disbands Wayne Industries, sets up free healthcare, sets up education programs for kids and stuff like that. And it's probably not going to be that. I'm only joking. But you know what? He would actually accomplish his goal much quicker if he was to do that, you know? But it's the very thing, it's the very beating up on the criminals in the evening that makes him feel well-rested, gets up, and then does this business. And what you can talk about the distinction between subjective violence and objective violence. The subjective violence is crime. Now, I live in an area called a village in Belfast. It sounds nice, but believe me, it's not. And there's a lot of crime and stuff in the area. And some of my friends don't necessarily like to come in, or at least at the beginning, because it had a bad reputation. But I was saying to them, they're just, the people you live with on your street, they're just a better class of criminal. They'll rob you blind with a handshake and a suit, you know. Okay, my guys, they'll nick your TV, you know, and they'll smash your window. But these guys, they'll rob you every month, you know. They'll take money off you without you even, and you'll be thanking them for it, you know. You know, imagine that. You're a criminal and you're actually... that's someone breaks into my house, steals my TV, and then forces me to say thanks. That's terrible. That would be even worse. That's even worse than them taking my TV. They put a gun and say, "Now say thank you for me taking this." "Thank you. You know, thanks." You know, and say, "Come again." "Come again." You know? But that's... You know, that would be horrible. That would be even more traumatic for me. And yet, the criminals in the areas where my friends live, that's exactly what they do. "Oh, thanks very much. Yes, I'll be back," you know? So... And that's why Brecht says, you know, what is the act of robbing a bank in comparison to the act of founding a bank? You know, like in terms of maybe a bank that invests in torture equipment, and that invests in companies that get blood diamonds or cocoa beans from war zone areas, and all these. Now, it's complicated, isn't it? But the violence is objectified. So it's not that the bank manager's fault. They're maybe a nice person, but the violence has now been objectified into a structure, and it's a structure that we need to kind of start to wrestle with. Why am I saying all this? Because our religious activities, how much could they become the same as Batman? I.e., we on a Tuesday night we kind of work with some homeless people, and on Thursday morning I've got a prayer group, and on Sunday I go to church. And it's these actual activities that are the air vent that actually allow us to not really look at our social existence and look at the jobs we're doing, look at the relationships we're in, look at the poverty and make real change, because that's always so much more difficult. So we have these places where we can go. So in like the Matrix, the very site of resistance, the very thing that we think is the thing that's changing things, is the very thing that's preventing real change from happening. And then, here's the really crazy bit. You've got to take away the fetish. You've got to take away the security blanket. So what does that look like? I'll just quote something. Here's a wee story for you. Always like a wee story. Okay, there's this fiery preacher. I think I can remember it without reading it. Preacher who had this amazing gift. It was an unusual gift. He found that from a young age, when he prayed for people, they would supernaturally lose all of their faith. All of their religious conviction. So, of course, as a religious man, he decided, "No, I'm never going to pray for anybody." And he limited himself to, sermons and good works. But one day, while he was traveling to a conference, he met this very, very wealthy merchant banker sitting next to him, reading the Bible. And they got talking. And as they talk, this guy, who's respected by his friends and feared by his adversaries, says, I'm a Christian myself. And he says, my world of work is sometimes a cold and heartless one. But, I know deep down that I'm a person of Christ, that I'm born into Jesus, and that, that's where my real identity is. And he says, I remind myself of that. I go to prayer groups, I go to church, and it stops me from getting too caught up in this heartless world of work that I'm in, right? So the preacher thinks for a second and then says, can I pray for you? And the guy goes, yeah, it'd be lovely. So he puts his hand on his head and prays a simple blessing. When the businessman opens his eyes, he's like amazed at how foolish he's been. He says, there's no God above. There's no Holy Scriptures to guide me. There's no Holy Spirit within me. There's nothing. And so he went away. But now that he had to face up to the fact that he was just a hard-nosed businessman, he found it really difficult. Had a breakdown. Gave up his job, gave money away, started using his managerial expertise to work for a local charity, a non-profit organization, and began to really change his life. And then one day, years later, he came across the preacher again, ran up to him, fell at his feet and began to weep and said, thank you for helping me discover my faith. That's what Bonhoeffer means when he talks about religionless Christianity. He says Christianity that is fully engaged in the world, where God is fully found in the midst of people. I want to leave a bit of time for Q&A, so I'll try and sum up what Bonhoeffer said in 5 minutes. He says this, he says, as soon as you give God a place, 5 minutes in Bonhoeffer, is that where you're smiling? No. yeah. Bonhoeffer, and then Heidegger in 2 minutes. So we've got God has assigned a place, and then that place is always on the outside, as God who gives meaning, as God who we bring in when we're suffering. So he says, clergy begin to look like the worst kind of gutter journalists. So he says, it's like they're always sniffing around people's private lives, trying to find out who they're having sex with, who they're touching, He says, it's like the worst kind of gutter. It's as if you couldn't enjoy a beautiful house without first finding a cobweb in the corner, You couldn't enjoy you couldn't smell and love the flowers without finding the dung that they grow out of, right? So God then suddenly becomes privatized and comes reduced from life, from everyday life, and is no longer part of our whole existence. So then he negates that, and he says, so let's deny God entirely. Let's say, right, I want to live fully in the world and deny God a place. And that's a really good thing for him, because he says, we have a tendency, what do people want? We want a leader we can dominate. We want a leader who tells us what we want them to say, right? So that when they say it, if it doesn't work, we can blame them and not ourselves. We want someone else to take responsibility for our own thoughts, and we could talk loads more about that. In fact, I'm going to later on, because for me, the role of the leader in Christian community is to refuse leadership. Right? So he says, let's take full responsibility for our actions in the world. Let's fully live in the world and embrace it. But then, of course, Bonhoeffer goes a step further, and he says, and imagine if that is the means of living before God. By denying God a place, God becomes truly omnipotent, inhabiting every place, everywhere, no longer on the edges, but infused. And so we find God not as out there justifying something, but in the naked stranger, in the outstretched hand of the one who is hungry, who is thirsty, in the flesh of the tortured victim. So for Bonhoeffer, this is a negation of negation. And And he says, so this is how he interprets Paul, the law written in your hearts. Because when the law comes in from an outside third, right, when you hear God speak to you from outside, well, what does that do? Well, that generates the very activity that is prohibiting, okay? You say to a kid, when I leave the room, you don't open that cookie jar. What does the kid want to do? He wants to open a cookie jar, Or just, don't open that envelope when I leave the room. The kid probably didn't even notice the envelope until you said that. And then suddenly the kid will just be, oh, I want to open the envelope, because the prohibition is the very thing that generates the thing which it prohibits. It's an implicit affirmation, So that's why Paul understood that the law and sin are not opposites. They're actually intertwined deeply. And that's why someone like Jerry Falwell, is that Jerry Falwell's guy who's kind of, he preached against sleeping around with guys and then was sleeping around with guys, is that him? Yeah, well, that's why, no. Ted Haggard. Oh, yeah. What did Falwell do? Anything yet? Okay, that's okay. Because I did use Falwell in this example, so I'm worried that now I've spread a rumor that he's kind of sleeping around a lot. If he's a nice guy, I don't know. Did he? Well, okay, then he deserves what I said. Okay. He blamed 9/11 on gays, did you say? Wow, that's amazing. I knew that plane looked pink. That was it. Yeah, that was weird. Yeah, so the other guy, people would say, oh, Ted Hagert, he's being inauthentic, you know, he's preaching one thing, he's being a hypocrite. By the way, Nietzsche said, you know, I said, I wish there were more hypocrites in the world, you know, and I said, you know, at least a hypocrite believes something and doesn't do it, you know, so many people today don't even believe anything, it would be brilliant if they could actually get to be a hypocrite, you know, I'd prefer to be give me a hypocrite any day over somebody who just doesn't believe anything, you know, so, you know, you could actually go, well, he genuinely maybe believed what he was saying, but it was a prohibition that he hadn't internalized. So it came, and the more he ranted and raved against what he didn't want to do, the more the desire was to do it. Which is anything, like anybody who rants and raves about something, of course the question is, you know, are you doing that yourself? Because they're experiencing it as this prohibition which generates the very behavior. So whenever Paul says, it's written in your hearts. Kingdom of God is within you. There's a sense in which this kingdom is internalized and becomes a part of our, what Kierkegaard, as I said at the beginning, calls radical subjectivity. Not in the sense of we subjectively create it, but in the sense that it is so within us, intimately embedded within us. And that's the negation and negation. Now, any Q&A? I'm going to build on this. It's going to get better. Oh, I can't wait. You know. But anyway, any Q&A? What's that, sorry? Christianity.
What does the term Christianity mean?
Christianity? Yeah. Did I say that? No.
Or Christality.
Christality? I've never heard the term before. Oh, wow. Well, you tell me. Oh, it's something you thought I said? Right, so these guys haven't heard a word I've said. It's just this crazy, thick Irish accent. Oh, yeah. I worry. This happens all the time to me. Yeah. I said in an interview, it was... The word of God can't be heard without being heeded. And she was going, oh, yeah, that's really weird. And she was saying, he says the word of God can't be heard without being hated. And I go, I didn't say hated. I didn't say hated. I said heeded. Heed. To heed something, not to hate something. So that's all. Terrible, you know. So is there, I could make it. I could retroactively create a justification because that's what we do. That's what Freud found out. Whenever you hypnotize someone, you get them to carry an umbrella up in the inside their house, and then you unhypnotize. Why'd you do that? Oh well, I wanted to see if the umbrella worked. You retroactively justify your behavior. Now, that's why. Something like Icon. I started Icon not having a clue what it was about, but I retroactively have got a whole pile of philosophy to justify every single move, you know? So, yeah, any other thoughts, questions?
Just wondering what anti-evangelism and ministry would look like, say, I'm volunteering in prison ministry, people who kind of hit rock bottom, just wanted to hear some thoughts about.
Absolutely. So anti-evangelism, which I just kind of made up earlier, but I do like it. But what would an anti-evangelism ministry look like? Well, for me, Emmanuel Levinas uses a distinction between the saying and the said. And he said, so much people think religious truth is on the level of the said, that whenever someone's suffering, you give them an answer, you know, God, and you give them a reason. But Emmanuel Levinas, the Orthodox Jew, you know, says, no, religious answer is at the level of saying. It's a level of flesh touching flesh, of being beside and being with. So if you think of the music of Sigur Rós, I don't know if you have Sigur Rós here, but Sigur Rós are an Icelandic band, and they're amazing, absolutely beautiful. And they use a language called Hoplandic, and it's not a language at all, they just make it up. The words don't mean anything. But, you know, you'll get a very teary when you listen to it. I don't know what they're saying, but they're saying something, you know, deep down, you know, is really, really resonating with me. And for me, an anti-evangelistic ministry is a ministry of pure presence, flesh touching flesh, where that's where God's word is spoken. And whenever we do that, that's where real comfort happens, and we strengthen each other. And then once the person... I think is in a better place, a more healthy place, then they may want to come along and be part of the collectives that we're part of and engage with that activity. That comes later. I think as well, the stuff that I'm doing later on this afternoon will give an even deeper answer to that question, you know. Any other thoughts? By the way, we have an evangelism project in Icon, which is a group where we go out to be evangelized. So it's like where we visit other religious communities to be transformed. So we did the Scientologists a few weeks ago. That was a good laugh. They are mad. It's very hard to be evangelized by the Scientologists. But yeah, so that's a different form of anti-evangelism, not the type we're talking with you, but it's another form of kind of... Because basically, what are Christians? Well, Christians are people who are starting a journey of being evangelized. As Gabriel Marcel says, the French playwright, I am the one who needs to be converted. And actually entering into Christianity is entering into a becoming of Christianity. I often call myself becoming Christian, although at the moment I'm a non-Christian in the Christian sense of the term. I'm going to explain that later. But in other words, there's a problematic nature of Christianity. Christianity is an irreligious religion. We'll talk about that later. So what am I saying? What was I saying? So like an Icon, where each instrument will be for each other's further conversion. It's not a seeker service. Icon is we meet in a bar, atheist, theist, liberal, conservative, Protestant, Catholic. We engage in these, what we call theodrama, theopoetics, and transformance art. These kind of poetry, ritual, art nights, which are designed to not offend anybody by offending everybody. We try and offend everybody equally. But the thing is, nobody feels got at an Icon. There's like in a seeker service, somebody comes in and goes, I know they're trying to reach me. And as soon as they feel like that, your heckles are up. In Icon, we go, no, we're each instruments of each other's further conversion. No one's trying to get you. In fact, you're here to teach us. But ironically, that breaks down the us and them. So if I say to someone, I believe in God for X, Y, and Z, the other person will say, I don't believe in God for X, Y, and Z. And like any argument, you're like this. And it takes one person to say, well, sometimes I wonder if there is a God. Sometimes I wonder if there is any meaning to life. And what does the other person do? They go, oh, brilliant, yeah, fantastic. Well, they might do, but the primary response might be, well, sometimes I wonder if there is a God. Sometimes I wonder if there is more to life and whatever. And then suddenly the real dialogue begins. So for me, again, evangelism is the most destructive way of doing evangelism. Any other thoughts?
That's actually related to a conversation I was having when we were driving here from Canada. Just talking about non-fetish-based sort of authentic experience of faith and God and spirituality. As you become increasingly aware of yourself and your context, and your interactions become more referential to things that you've experienced before or feel, like have you ever had a conversation where you feel like you're living a cliche almost, how does that look for you that you can actually have those things aside as you become more and more aware of how many layers of reference are all around you when you're interacting?
I'm not too sure. Keep tease it out a bit more for me.
That in a sense, in your quest for authenticity, you're almost being stifled by a barrage of irony and trying to step out of something, you become increasingly aware of those layers around you which actually inhibit you from having this non-fetish authenticity that you're talking about. I'm just trying to see is that clear?
Yeah, well, are you saying that, the more you realize you don't know, the more difficult it is to naively believe, and then once, how do you continue to live as Christ or whatever, whenever you're no longer a naive believer? Is that right, when you've got doubt, complexity, and ambiguity riven through your belief system? I don't know if that's what you're saying.
It's on track.
It's on track with that. Yeah, that's great. Well, for me, and we'll look at this more in a second, but there's a parable about two rabbis, and these two rabbis are arguing about a passage in the Torah, and they've been arguing for 20 years over what it means. Sometimes they change their minds, whatever, but they never find agreement. And finally, God gets so pissed off at this, right? God says to the angels, I'm going to go down, I'm going to tell them what it means. So the angels step back, God goes down, parts the cloud, says to the two rabbis, I've listened to you guys argue for 20 years over this, what this means. I'll tell you what it means. And in a rare moment of unity, the two rabbis turn to God and say, what right have you to come down to heaven from heaven and tell us what it means? You bugger off and let us argue about it, right? Now, that, for me, is the heart of a Christianity beyond belief and the Judeo-Christian tradition, which is this, that actually it's not about belief, primarily. It's about what the rabbis had is they have belonging. They're both mates. They both come every day to the park to chat. And they have shared rituals. They have shared behavior, because they're both rabbis. They both engage in the rituals of the community. And so for me, Christianity fundamentally can embrace doubt, ambiguity, and complexity because it's actually about something much deeper. Just like a family, you know, a child is born into a family and it belongs before there's any behaviour or belief. And then the behaviour comes second, and when they go walking in parks, when the parents can walk in parks, whatever the rituals of the family are. And then finally, belief comes last, and it's first mimics the parents, and then in adolescence, it's likely to diametrically oppose. And then when you get a bit older, it's likely to find some sort of equilibrium. What I'm trying to do, and how not to speak, or well, primarily in Fidelity of Betrayal, second book, is the subtitle is Towards a Church Beyond Belief. And I'm literally trying to explore the idea of that belief is not the primary concern within Christianity. Don't know if that's tracking with your answer, but I'll throw that. Yeah. Anyway, I'm like a politician. Whatever question you ask, I will tell you the answer I want. I'll hear the question that I want to hear, you know. So, sorry. I've got the floor. Oh, you and then you. Yep. That's Keelan. How's it going?
I'm thinking about the distinction between subjective violence and objective violence.
Yeah. Okay. In both his daily activity and at night. I don't know. I'm not sure if I've completely got what you're saying, because I think, I mean, the connection between the objective and subjective violence is fascinating, because obviously it means the very thing that we are subjectively find abhorrent and the very thing subjectively we are fighting against is the very thing objectively in the coffee we're drinking while we're talking about it, or the car we're driving while we're discussing it. It's, you know, that you know, we've basically objectified our violence in a structure. So we can be pacifists and we can be ecumenical. We go up, we do all that subjectively because we've actually sublimated our violence into our activities. So you can be a pacifist who's, you know, actually engaged in an incredibly violent structure. But so that's that. But it's the connection. You want to make connection between that and, say, Icon. I'm not sure. Yes. Okay, yeah, absolutely. Well, I can say one thing. Ray Keelan's asking us, he was part of Icon way at the beginning. In fact, is responsible for the C becoming a K in Icon, if I remember correctly. Is that Icon has five coordinates, and their icon is iconic, apocalyptic, heretical, emerging, and feeling. And so feeling is one of our coordinates. And these are kind of ways of navigating the territory of Icon. And apocalypse means the incoming to the unknown and all that. But feeling, so part of what we're saying is we're a community who feels. Now, we don't try to feel, because if you try to feel and you're successful, and is that failure, you know? So we try to succeed in a sense, but it's about, for us, it's about a realization that we, there's never full presence. We can never pat ourselves on the back and say that we've done it. There's no sense in this side of the world where we're going to feel that absolute connection and oneness. So our idea of failure is simply acknowledging the fact that whenever you affirm the kingdom of God, you're always placing yourself under judgment, which is what someone like Lyotard would say is different. Well, he wouldn't say it, but projecting from it, what he says, that Christianity is one of the few systems that actually, by affirming it, you actually critique yourself. You're cutting it yourself. If you affirm a system that affirms you, then probably you're affirming it because you want to be affirmed. But to affirm a system that actually puts you under judgment, that's probably, it's more difficult for us to do, and there might be more genuine nature. So that's what we mean by failing an icon, you know, to acknowledge that structure. Also, we want to acknowledge failure because half the time we do stuff and it's rubbish. But that's a part of experimenting. You've got to be free to feel that, to play and to go, sometimes it won't work, and go, that's a success. I'll maybe one more question. I know we're running out of time. Or do you want to? Oh, you okay? Okay. Brilliant.